Hi, my name is Matt. I'm the founder of Regeneration Projects, a small business that sees two great bays and a river as our most important business partners. We started at a kitchen table during Melbourne's epic COVID-19 lockdown, and now we're a B Corp and actor in the UN decade on ecosystem restoration. As we begin this episode, we'd like to acknowledge the two great bays, Port Phillip and Western Port, which are known to First Peoples as Nam and Wurrumbirrin, or Murrumbik. Without the bays and the Birrarung Yarra River, we wouldn't be in business today. So we show deep respect to First Nations elders, past and present, who for over 60,000 years have cared for the bays, Birrarung, and their catchment areas. Their ecological knowledge inspires us to practice business in partnership with nature. Now, choosing a career that tackles environmental issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, or pollution can be incredibly rewarding, but also super tough. When we listen to the stories of passionate and pioneering professionals, it stokes our inner fire and belief so that we can keep doing the work that we know needs to be done to benefit future generations. That's what the Two Bays podcast is all about. Stories of hope, grit, and determination, inspiring the planet's next generation of ecological leaders and entrepreneurs. This series is made in partnership with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council and celebrates the stories of business and community champions at the forefront of local climate action. Let's tune in. Wamajika, welcome and come with purpose to the Two Bays podcast. My name's Matt Sykes, and along with Claire Wild, it's our pleasure to welcome you back for this, our final episode, as part of a collaboration with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council and a whole range of businesses and organisations around this beautiful region that are taking climate action into their own hands and really embedded into their different business models and everyday ways of working. In the spirit of the work that we do, we'll take a moment to acknowledge country, those Boomerang and Bunurong connections to the lands and waterways and skies of the Mornington Peninsula, and in particular, their elders past and present. We're going to be talking about seaweed farming in this episode, so we're going to do a shout out to those seagrasses, those underwater worlds that we often don't get to see but have incredible richness and biodiversity and add to the vibrancy of life on the peninsula, but also the local economy in different ways. Today we're joined by Cam Hines, who's the co-founder of Southern Sea Greens, and very, very interesting story in this changing relationship between, I guess, how we see our waterways locally, but things that have been practiced and very common, not only in this in our country, but also overseas more and more that we're seeing. Cam, thank you for joining us today, and really curious to jump straight in. Can you share a little bit more about your take on, I guess, this effort and this growth in climate action and consciousness on the Mornington Peninsula, and how that's just becoming a more mainstream part of daily life?
Yeah, well, it's unreal that it's happening and that awareness is building, and it feels like it's sort of snowballing, hopefully. The peninsula, as you well know, is surrounded with water. So if there's a place where you're really going to see impacts of climate change early, it's the peninsula. It's a lot of the country, obviously, you know, we're an island nation. But I think people on the peninsula are very proud and passionate about the environment and about just the beauty of the place. And we don't want to see it screwed up. And so isn't it great that finally sustainability seems to be becoming more mainstream and accepted?
Cam, I think you're completely right. The idea that sustainability is becoming more mainstream and accepted. And I'm going to guess that the work that you do at Southern Sea Greens has come about perhaps in response to sustainability not quite doing what it should, or our response to sustainability not quite being what it should be. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about the story of how it came to be and also why you started that initiative.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Well, so I grew up on the peninsula, sailing and surfing, and grew up on a farm too. So it was an upbringing that was, I guess I was always subjected to or very aware of what was at your disposal. So, yeah, of course, you know, you drink the rainwater rainwater from a tank, and you, you're eating vegetables, you know, that the family's growing out the back door. And it's a simple, essentially a sort of a sustainable way to grow up. And then I went to uni and moved up to the city and tried to take my kind of ethos into my life, and found it more difficult, or it felt disjointed and not quite right sort of operating in the city after I'd grown up down the coast the way I did. But anyway, I sort of took my ethos and my, I guess, my ultimate care for the planet into Mountain Goat, my previous business. And, you know, we had Australia's first, you know, organic beer, and we did all kinds of things. We had solar panels on heating our brewing water very, very early on. And we're paying our staff an incentive to ride their pushies, their push bikes to work. And so I've always had, you know, that deep interest and care, and it's something that I've been passionate about. And then after exiting that business, which was something like 7 years ago now, of course, you know, you get it, you have a rest, and but you have a bit of time and you start reading and thinking. And I guess I'm an entrepreneurial person, whether I like it or not. Some days I think it's great. Other days I think, God, it would be so much easier if I could just go to work and, you know, get a paycheck or whatever. But this is me and this is what I do. And I watched a Tim Flannery doco on the powers of seaweed. It was just on YouTube, went for like 45 minutes or something. And I got to the end of that and I'm like, what are we doing? You know, seaweed is here already. We are surrounded by water, and water on the peninsula that's very suitable for farming kelp. Yeah, why isn't Australia doing this already? It just seems insane. And at about the same time, my business, now business partner Bert, had watched the 2040 movie and saw, you know, just realized again, you know, the power of seaweed. And he's like, well, you know, I've got a background of, he's a commercial diver, ex-naval clearance diver, so an incredibly capable water human. And he's like, I could do that. I could build a, you know, a kelp farm. And his best mate, Rob, happens to have a really relevant an extensive science background. So at this point, I didn't know Rob and Bert, but we were kind of separately all kind of getting this concept together in our heads. And then I finally heard about Bert and his efforts, and we united. And then the business was, you know, off in earnest at that point. So that was about about 3 years ago we met up.
Awesome. What a cool story, Cam. Just to go back before we keep, I'd love to hear more about Southern Sea Greens before we get more into that conversation. Just a quick reflection. As someone who grew up in Aotearoa, New Zealand, which I know isn't quite the same is the Mornington Peninsula, but I wonder if it's similar in some ways where you have that really, well, nature's very much at your doorstep and you sort of, you know, grow up feeling very connected to nature. Now living in Nam, Melbourne, and I think, you know, I love living here, and then at the same time there are times where your life feels really disconnected from nature. Like at the moment I live in an apartment and I'm going through this big process to figure out how we can set up a composting system for our apartment block because the council doesn't collect our compost. And even last weekend, just feeling a little bit frazzled with life and knowing that I needed to get out. So I went to Yarra Bend and went for a big walk and looked at the flying foxes, like those little bats that live around there. And it's really interesting. I think it's so noticeable how those being disconnected from nature in your day-to-day life can really affect you. And so I think the story that the stories that you have about, you know, how you've made decisions about the impact of your career makes so much sense. And it's really cool to see the successes that you've had through those. So after that small tangent, back on the topic of Southern Sea Greens, we've talked a little bit about how it came to be. Would love to hear a little bit more about exactly what you do. How would you describe your purpose?
Well, I guess you could say that it's regenerative seaweed farming. So right now we do two main things. So first of all, we wild harvest. So we kami hunt, right? So in Port Phillip Bay, there's this seaweed called Undaria pinnativida, which is an introduced species. And it actually, a lot of Australians are quite familiar with it because when we go and eat Japanese and we have a seaweed salad or we have miso soup and we see some green stuff floating in there, that's wakame. And so wakame, Undaria pinnativida, made its way out here to Australia in the 80s in the bilge of a ship. So, and it basically spread, the ship's bilge was emptied, I believe, in Port Phillip Bay, and it's now all through Port Phillip Bay and some other parts of Victoria and all through Tasmania. And you might say, well, cool, that's great, that's more kelp, that's more seaweed, that's good for the planet. And in a sense, kind of, yes, but the problem is that it's an invasive, very prolific, opportunistic seaweed. It grows incredibly quickly and it crowds out our native species like Aclonia radiata or golden kelp. So we have a license to wild harvest wakame where we find it in Victoria. So one part of our business is we go out between July and end of October and we hunt wakame. So yeah, getting our wetsuits. It's usually not that far off the shore and it's on reefs, and we and it's sort of up to sort of 3 meters of depth. So it's easy to get. And we dive down with a sharp diver's knife and sever it below the sporophyll, which is the reproductive part. And take the whole plant out of the water and take it back to Dramana, to our warehouse, and we freshwater rinse it and then ambient air dry it with a dehumidification sort of set up in converted shipping containers. So we then, yeah, so once that's stable, seaweed has a very short life until it's been stabilized. So, and drying it very thoroughly is a good way to get it stable. And then it's great for like 2 or 3 years. So that's one part of our business. And of course, we then turn that into nutritious food products for humans. And then the other side of the business is so learning to breed native kelp. So at the moment we're working with Macrocystis, which is also known as giant kelp, and it's the stuff that's been decimated down through Tassie. There is still some Macrocystis growing in Victoria, but nowhere near the forests that we used to have and that I was, you know, snorkeling through as a kid down on the peninsula. So what we do is we go and take a couple of blades of mature healthy plants, and which does not affect the health of that plant in any way, and we take those blades, we look for reproductive tissue or sorus tissue. So it's basically tissue that has blotches and discoloration, sort of darker patches on it down near the base of the plant, and we take those samples back to the lab, which we've set up in our warehouse in Dramana, and we clean that tissue and then dehydrate it and then rehydrate it. So basically stressing it, and it releases all its spore. And we usually collect something like 50 million spore and then move it into sterile tanks where we're already set up with spools, PVC spools with twine wrapped all around them. And over about the next 5 or 6 weeks, young sporophytes, young baby kelp plants start to grow on the twine. And then at about 6 weeks of age, we take the spools with the twine out to our sea farm at Flinders, wrap it around our long lines down under the water, about 8 meters under. And then, and this is the magic of seaweed, it just needs excess nutrients that are already in the water and light from the sun, and it grows. And in growing, in doing its thing, photosynthesizing, it helps deacidify the sea, which is becoming increasingly a problem as there's more carbon in the atmosphere. The sea's trying to soak it up, and it does, but then the sea turns acidic. And when the sea is too acidic and out of balance, we start to lose a whole stack of marine life. So growing kelp is just wonderful for the marine ecosystem. So I've given you a really long answer, I know, sorry, and that felt like a bit of a tangent, but they're kind of the two parts of the business, the way we get our kelp. And then the next challenging part, if there weren't already enough challenges in trying to work out how to do all this, is how to show Australian consumers that seaweed could and should be part of our daily diet. And the main reasons being that it's just so fantastically sustainable as a zero input crop and as a regenerative crop, but also that it's, that seaweed is among the most densely nutritious vegetables on the planet. So for me, it's like, why weren't we doing this 10 years ago, you know, and how can we scale it and get an industry going as soon as possible?
Brilliant, Cam. I think you took us straight there to, you know, to the waters, to the lab, and the example of both taking away what has become an invasive species, but then also trying to regenerate and increase something that has been degraded over time. Yeah, a picture that makes it very relatable. And I think where you ended there around this challenge of, okay, building up the product and the production system, but then also the journey of education of our community so that people can start to build it into their lifestyles and have it as part of their diets. And I think that dynamic is something that a lot of us that are involved in, let's call it the broader regeneration movement, and films like 2040 and others that have helped, you know, popularize some of these concepts, where we're in this dance of we're making things and we're like trying to push the edge of something. And then there's this kind of ongoing dialogue until we get to a point where this stuff is just normal. And if you look at, you know, Japanese culture, where seaweed has been, you know, just a normal part of their diets for a very long time, even having spent time in Tassie with the Palawa Pakenham people there and them talking about different uses, including through food of seaweed plants. So yeah, it feels like we're in this dance very much so. And you've done this dance before with the organic steam ale you were mentioning before. It's actually my favorite go-to beer. I've got a wedding coming up and that will be the preferred drop on available there. Cam, I just wanted to check in, you know, one of the things that has come up and we've presented as a bit of a challenge or a creative friction, let's say, between business and environmental outcomes. What comes through in your story is that this is part of a holistic integrated system and there's no trade-off, it's just part of an operation. But what I'm particularly interested in is how that relates to a growing generation of, let's say, ecological entrepreneurs that are just doing this from the outset. From your experience, what do you think is key in being in some of these pioneering fields and being at the edge and in that dance between education and creating products and markets so that people don't lose faith, they keep charging and they keep moving forward?
Well, I think that, well, just likening this for a minute to like a carrot and a stick concept. So I think people who are enlightened and have done enough reading and can see what the hell it is that's going on in front of us right now, that's easy, right? And so a business like us, like ours, and like so many others, people who are doing wonderful things, It's kind of easy to find passionate supporters, and for that matter, passionate and committed staff and customers and people who want to collaborate, and that's unreal. So that's cool. And that's just kind of part of the DNA with our business, at least. But I think what I think is starting to happen and is definitely going to happen more, I reckon, is the stick end of the equation, in that I have this, and maybe this is a bit idealistic, I don't know, or arrogant, but my feeling is that, like, if you are in business today, and especially if you are starting a business today, it's like, well, how is this business going to serve the planet? And if you can't answer that well and confidently, and you don't like the answer, then I think you've really got to stop right there and go, okay, well, does the planet need another one of these businesses, or can we create something different and far better that maybe has not been thought of yet? And so I think what is starting to happen, and I kind of hope starts to happen, is that certain companies are going to start getting punished by consumers just going, I don't want any part of that. And I think there's enough enlightened humans now on the planet to start making a difference in that regard by just acting and taking their money elsewhere. And hopefully that will just start to sort shit out. If governments don't put enough guidelines and rules in place, I think the smart humans on the planet will just slowly sort it out themselves. And some of these businesses that are just not sustainable and not interested in what they're doing to the planet will just be in less favor increasingly, and hopefully cease to be, or more hopefully they will adapt. And a lot are realizing, okay, shit, we've got to start giving back, but it's got to be more than a token, you know, let's put out a press release, we're going to set up a fund, $10,000 to help us start up. It's got to be so much more. But anyway, that's my take on it. Is it idealistic? Maybe. I don't know.
I think, Cam, that is not idealistic. I think it's what needs to happen. Interesting to go down this slightly philosophical route, but I also think this is particularly for the last episode of this series. I think it's a really important thing for us to touch on. I spend lots of my week working with businesses, helping them to become more quote unquote sustainable. And what our conversations boil down to is often, Cam, exactly what you're talking about. That notion of, I'm not sure if either of you or any of our listeners are familiar with the meme. I feel like I'm now making a meme reference on a podcast where there's those three Spider-Men and they're all pointing at each other. And sometimes it feels a little bit like that when it comes to sustainability and regeneration in particular. You know, you've got the businesses saying, we're just waiting on the consumers to change their demand. And you've got the consumers saying, we're just waiting on the businesses to change their supply. And then you've got the businesses also relying on the regulators to change, you know, what they're enforcing and the rules that are there. And it's sort of everyone's waiting for somebody else to do something. And what you've talked about, where some of those old business models that are fundamentally unsustainable and degenerative maybe need to not be here anymore. And the examples that you've given around completely new ways of doing business and new ways of understanding the purpose of a business and, you know, the role that a business plays in society and also the relationship that business has with our planet is, in my view, and I think reflecting on some of the conversations we've had throughout this entire series, it's really the future, I would say, of our economy.
Yeah, and I think the emergence and the popularity of the B Corp movement is really heartening and hopefully a sign of progress. And aren't they doing a wonderful job in enrolling suitable organisations and putting the good word out there and helping promote them. So 1% for the planet is another ripper. And you know, role models like Patagonia, you know, who are so influential. So hopefully this snowball keeps building as we as we move forward.
Yeah, awesome. Kim, it sounds like you're breaking a lot of new territory, and throughout the stories that you've told us, there's a really clear theme that have come through around noticing what's wrong or what needs to be fixed and trying something new that isn't necessarily always the most trodden path. And so I'd love, given that this has been your approach to business, it sounds like, throughout your career, I'd love for you to share perhaps just one or two pearls of wisdom with our listeners, in particular for those listeners who might be right at the beginning of their career and seeing all of these challenges that we're facing, and, you know, the meta crisis, the biodiversity crisis, the climate crisis, all the stuff that's going on. And if you could just share a couple of pearls of wisdom to perhaps help them make decisions about how to have an impactful career, what would that be?
Well, first of all, I would say that there's a very good book out there by a guy called Rick Rubin, and it's called The Creative Act. Have you guys heard about it or read it? So Rick Rubin's a famous American music producer, and you might have heard the name, and he's been involved in almost every incredibly successful artist that's come out of the States in the last couple of decades or more. And he talks about, in this book, which is just written so well, and I feel so grateful, my ex-business partner Dave from Mountain Goat put this book in front of me and said, I reckon you'd like this, Cam, and I've read it several times now. But basically, it's all about the importance of doing what we need to do to allow creativity to flow, all right? So when we start a business, it's very easy to get very busy, too busy to have time to do anything else, right? Like other stuff, fun stuff, whatever. And this book is all about saying you just have to stop and do whatever is required to put yourself in a space that allows creativity to flow. Because when you're starting a business, it's bloody stressful, and there's all these barriers and hurdles that keep popping up, as you would appreciate. And yeah, it can be, you can be become very reactive, and also you can become kind of very fixed on what you intended the business was going to look like by this particular point in time. And I guess so the things that I'm that are present in my mind at the moment, and especially starting another business again now, are that it's okay if we, as long as we work hard and we're bloody tenacious and we allow creativity to happen within us on a pretty regular basis, like it's okay not to know all the answers and to see the actual path. So I sort of think, like when I started Mountain Goat, we met with a lawyer and an accountant, like all friends and friends of friends who were trying to help us out to get started and giving us advice. And we were told several times, like, just don't do it, because it's a bit mad in that it doesn't seem to add up financially and the market's not ready and the big brewers will basically crush you, right? And Dave and I were like, yep, hear that, understand it, and we don't exactly know what the journey is going to look like, but we have enough sort of belief in the concept that there should be more choice and beer with flavor that we're just going to go down that path anyway and just see what happens, you know. And the first 10 years, it was ultimately us drinking our own beer and getting our mates to go in and order our beers from our local pubs. But with time, we kind of found our path and found the beers that might resonate and actually work. And we made lots of crappy beer and made lots of bad decisions and lots of mistakes along the way. But we just stuck at it and kind of allowed it to unfold in the way that it wanted to. So it's this tension of kind of push, and then allow to happen. And I find that really hard sometimes, getting that balance right. I still find it hard, and I have to catch myself. But so I'm going off on another tangent here, I know. But my key points are that, like, tenacity is everything. Like, so many people you hear about, you know, talking about ideas and actually getting up and making it happen and doing it is a very different thing. But allowing yourself to be creative throughout the cycle of the business, because how can we know when we start out? We know nothing about it, like, you know, nothing. So we just have to learn and keep reading and allow and listen to lots of people and connect with humans who, you know, are kind of aligned with us, and allow it to unfold the way it wants to unfold, but not in a lazy way. Does that kind of answer the question?
It absolutely does, Cam. Thank you so much. I might hand to Matt now to wrap us up.
Cam, that was a terrific response. And I think as we start to, as you say, Claire, wrap up this series where we've journeyed to different, you know, businesses, organizations, different parts of the peninsula, and really zoomed into, I guess, the front line of climate leadership in its many forms in this local area. It's nice to kind of come up for air. And I think it's very timely that when this episode comes to be, it will actually be very close to what the Boomerang people know or share as deep winter. And it's part of that creative rejuvenation process. And I think sometimes, and maybe, you know, I'm in the same boat here, you know, Cam, you get so fixated in developing the work and creating campaigns and outreach and then getting caught up in delivery that we actually don't allow ourselves that space to reconnect with nature, to be in that creative flow. And yeah, if not all the time, then definitely seasonally, to allow that bit of extra bandwidth. And I think your story coming from, you know, Mountain Goat, I think for many listeners, people are familiar with that brand. And so when they hear you talking about seaweed and they're like, what, we're going to be eating seaweed? I mean, you know, I thought that's only what we do when we go to a Japanese restaurant. You know, people can kind of connect the dots and say, yeah, well, maybe we probably will be. You know, I remember coming across the Mountain Goat beer for the first time. I think it was at the Press Club in Melbourne. My uncle was living close by and he's like, I gotta show you this beer. It's called Mountain Goat. And he's got a great affinity with the country. So he loved, you know, your branding and your story and your icon and whatnot. But I guess this is the transition that we are on, and that's what we wanted to try and do, spark these little conversations and to create these seeds of hope that other people can grow in their own stories. So while it's awesome to listen to your story and the other champion stories, really it's about our listeners. It's about you all thinking, hey, what's next in my journey? How does this continue or enable me to continue doing what I'm doing? But maybe there's that strange radical idea that came to you when you were watching a movie or reading a book that just won't leave you alone. Claire, on that note, I'm going to pass to you before we wrap up here and just use a couple of moments. Is there anything that you'd like to share as a closing reflection to this series, working in partnership, of course, with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council, enabled through one of their climate action grants?
Yeah, absolutely. So firstly, just absolute massive thanks to the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council. I think it's been such a special time to be able to record these episodes. I'm not sure whether any of our listeners followed some of our previous podcasts, which at the time were called Voices of Regen. And I think those started out very much, Matt, as you described, as a bit of an idea that came to us during the COVID-19 lockdowns. And I think that was the way that we ran those episodes was really organic. And this particular series has been so amazing. To have a little bit more maturity, professionalism in the sense of production behind it. And of course, having so many excellent guests such as yourself on, Cam. Maybe a couple of reflections in terms of what we've heard. I think something that has stood out to me time and time again is this idea of taking a step, not necessarily trying to get everything perfect before you take action, but just seeing something that you can do and trusting your own instincts and your own judgment, and taking a step in the direction that you feel is right. I think, Cam, you've so many of the examples that you've given have been around trusting your gut, and doing what you see is impactful. And we've heard that from a lot of our other guests as well. So if there's anything that we can leave our listeners with, I'd say it's that. It's just, you know, taking that first step, no matter how small it might feel right now.
Cam, any closing wisdom from yourself?
I just say that I feel incredibly grateful. Well, first of all, you guys doing what you're doing and sharing the stories is fabulous. And how great this Climate Action Grant is that you have received for what you're doing, and that we received for helping establish our native kelp nursery at Dramana. And I'm also just incredibly grateful to the local, our local supporters, so retailers and the likes of Torello in Dramana and others, and also the local chefs who are just embracing you know, an ingredient that hasn't traditionally really been used much at all, and they're imagining completely new ways of using it, which just blows my mind every time I hear something new. And Point Leo Estate at the moment are making a or in Laura, they're sort of their high-end restaurant, they've got a Wakami donut in the mix on the menu. I was like, whoa, did not imagine that. But yeah, so it's just, yeah, feel very grateful that although it's really early days and we've got a long way to go with this business, even until we get anywhere near break-even point, but we're sort of getting the reception and the responses that are probably beyond what I was hoping for at this stage. So yeah, feel very grateful.
Brilliant. Well, there you go, folks. As we wrap up this first series of the Two Bays podcast, Cam from Southern Sea Greens, it's been an absolute pleasure, ground and now in the entrepreneurial space. I think that will be of great interest to many of our listeners. Folks, keep an eye out. This is the end of season one, but there is another one on the way, and we can confirm that this will be spotlighting the Birrarung and the Yarra River and its evolving relationship with Melbourne's community. And of course, business is a key part in that. This has been the Two Bays podcast with Claire and Matt. Over and out for now. Cheers, everyone. How amazing are those Mornington Peninsula climate champions? Must be something in the water. Against the odds, they're transforming climate anxiety into climate action. Keep your eyes out for new episodes coming soon. So you're feeling inspired and ready to act. What can you do next? Firstly, subscribe to the Two Bays podcast on your favorite channel. Then visit the Regeneration Project's website for more info about our ecological leadership and strategic consultancy work. Lastly, don't forget to follow Regeneration Projects on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, as well as subscribe to our seasonal newsletter. My name is Matt, and on behalf of Regeneration Projects and the Two Bays, thank you for tuning in, and see you on the next episode of Two Bays, a Business and a Kitchen Table podcast.